This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When it comes to bohemian art scenes and creative subcultures, the South has often been overshadowed and sometimes even dismissed in favor of metropolitan areas like New York or San Francisco. But a new book highlights the creative thinkers and diverse art scenes that influenced culture in the South and had a strong influence and effect on art scenes in northern states as well. The Bohemian South, Creating Countercultures from Poe to Punk, is a collection of essays that delve into the world of off-center cultures. Sean Chandler Bingham and Lindsay Freeman are co-editors and contributors to the book. Sean is Assistant Dean of Academic Affairs of the Honors College and a professor of sociology at the University of South Florida. Sean, welcome.
Thank you, sir. Good to be here.
And Lindsay is a professor of sociology at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. Hello, Lindsay.
Hi, good morning.
Let's talk about the language you use in this book. I mean, we do countercultures and bohemian. Let's start with counterculture. What do you mean when you say counterculture? Lindsay?
Well, when we're thinking about countercultures, I like to think about the countercultures being something that's oppositional to mainstream culture. So, you know, a subculture could be really anything that's a little bit outside mainstream culture, like, I don't know, something like collecting old globes or something like this. But a counterculture actually is a challenge, is an antagonism to mainstream culture.
And how do you know one when you see one, Lindsay?
You know, that's a good question, right? But I think you feel it, right? There's something visceral about countercultures. You can see the challenge. It offers a new possibility and opens up kind of a new way of thinking or living.
And for a very long time, Sean, the term bohemian was the sort of metaphor or another way to say counterculture. But tell us about that. You're talking about the origins of that term, and I found it instructive in your book. Sean, tell us about it.
Yeah, so it's as academics like to say, it's certainly a contested term. The way we use it in the book is to explore countercultural groups that are interested in creative expression, novelty of experience, very eclectic experiences, experimenting in different ways of living. So it's as much about those things as it is about reacting to maybe a more bourgeois lifestyle, a pre-programmed or conventional lifestyle.
Well, but that's what makes it interesting. It goes back at least to the 19th century when it was used, and it may perhaps refer to the Roma people, a kind of romantic attachment to being detached from the mainstream culture, and identifying with that, saying, yeah, that's you, and we are absolutely not a part of that. So countercultural, counter-capitalist for a while, but then you also talk about the ways in which these strands kind of run into each other, and it becomes very bourgeois, and then it stops being that way. So it's fascinating stuff. Lindsay, talk about then what this means for the South, because, yeah, down here we don't really think of ourselves as apart from the mainstream. So talk about the inherent tension that you address in your collection of essays.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, I think like a lot of the South is a part of the mainstream, right? So what we are looking for is as these pockets of difference or, you know, as we say, countercultures. And one of the things that drew me to the work and thinking about this with Sean and the fantastic contributors we have is that I thought that the South was often completely ignored in talking about, you know, larger contributions to American culture. Quite often, or if it was, it was just on a consumption base. So, for example, I began to see in, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s in New York City, like the hot cuisine everywhere was Southern cuisine, you know, Nashville hot chicken and great biscuits and all of these things, but without really thinking about where these things are coming from and the cultures that produce them. And food is just one example. I mean, I think also many, many types of music, such as old-time music, I found really emerging across sort of what we think of as the cultural capitals of the U.S., places like New York and places like San Francisco, but not really thinking about the roots of these genres or styles of music. And not thinking at all about the communities that produce them.
But those would be the mainstream. Those would be the things that any Southerner would easily identify with, not the countercultures. If you talk about art scenes, poetic scenes, I mean, and we get into some of the critiques that go back to Mencken, you know, challenging the South for not having an ear for poetry and that sort of thing. But you do find those things down here just in kind of hidden pockets, not quite as visible as they are in the North. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the really great chapters of the book, I think, is about Black Mountain College, which was this amazing experimental college in the mid-20th century in, you know, the small town of Black Mountain outside of Asheville, where you had major, major players of the avant-garde, both in poetry and painting and dance, all of these different art forms. And you know, lots of people in the area don't know very much about Black Mountain College, that it existed. So there is a sense that a lot of these places really were kind of tucked away.
And again, a very different approach, whereas Greenwich Village might be a place where someone with an aspiration to bohemian lifestyle would go because it's an open environment, because, you know, if I go to New York, even if people aren't open to my idea, at least they won't be antagonistic. Not so with Black Mountain. I mean, Black Mountain itself became a cultural safety zone. But as you say, the surrounding communities perhaps were antagonistic to some of the ideas that were promoted there.
That's right. And especially during Jim Crow, you know, Black Mountain College did have some black students. And this was felt to be quite controversial in the area at large. And so, you know, John Carter, who writes about this in our book, he talks about how, you know, this is very great for Black Mountain College and for the students when they're there, but they did, you know, have a difficult time when they had to go to town and, you know, people were telling them to ride in the back of the bus and this kind of thing. So there are a lot of tensions in these places.
Sean, the book is a collection of essays, and to start these discussions, there are a few characters who influenced Bohemia. So tell us about Edgar Allan Poe and why he is considered a part of a Southern counterculture.
Sure, and so there's an excellent chapter in the book by Ed Whitley, which addresses Edgar Allan Poe, who wasn't born in what we consider the South, but was adopted by a Richmond family, the Allens, never really felt like he belonged in the class in which he found himself, felt out of place, kind of in the cotillion society, and took that sense of not belonging with him. He did go to college in Virginia for a little while and lived in Richmond with the Allens, but then when he moved to New York, took that out of placeness with him and was more of a proto-bohemian in terms of influencing the scene. There really wasn't a bohemian scene when he moved to New York City. But he's considered the forefather of Southern Gothic and Southern Renaissance, but really influenced those who came after him in the New York scene over the next 50, 60 years. They all looked back to Edgar Allan Poe, who much of his thoughts on class had been shaped by being raised in Richmond South.
Yeah, I think, Lindsay, that's another important aspect of these essays and what they reveal. To some extent, where to find the hidden counterculture enclaves in the South, but to a large extent, how Southerners influenced what came to be known as the bohemian scene in places like New York City. I mean, talk about Ada Clare.
Yeah, right, absolutely. Ada Clare was such a fascinating character. She comes out of Charleston, a rich plantation family, and she really develops a bohemian scene in Greenwich Village. And she at first, you know, kind of grows out of cafe culture, pub culture, but then she starts hosting a salon at her home. And she saw these salons firsthand in Paris and wanted to replicate this, you know, back in New York. And what was funny is that she kind of tried to fool people for a while that she was from Paris, but it came out that she was Southern. And a lot of people think that a lot of her skills at building this salon and building this community around her were kind of honed coming out of hosting and in the Southern plantation that she comes from.
Yeah, the idea of Southern hospitality to entertain at a salon, to bring together, writers like Walt Whitman and others in this circle, does at least make some reference to Southern hospitality, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. That's right. Yeah.
What about in the South itself, areas where we may not be looking for it, but there are enclaves of counterculture that are thriving and surviving quite well down here? Lindsay, I'll stick with you for a minute, and then I'll ask you, Sean.
Okay, sure. One of the things that I think about right off is, I mentioned old-time music before, but there's a brand new, there's a relatively new kind of set of counterculture around old-time music that is being performed and composed by train-hopping punks. And they've started to build communities around the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina and Virginia, and they kind of travel around on trains, but also sometimes build their own homes and communities in the mountains there. And I think that that's something you wouldn't necessarily expect to see. These folks that have become, you know, so impassioned by mountain music, traditional music, and have this kind of tension between a traveling lifestyle and also a real attachment to place, which is these mountains.
Well, and that's the point. And I think one of the places or one of the areas in which the South has a comparative advantage, if you're trying to be a counterculture, is the wide open spaces. And so on the one hand, culturally, there may not be the comfort level among most of its citizens. There certainly is the space to practice off-the-grid living, and I think that's one of the things that comes through in these essays. Sean, you wrote an essay that's featured in the book that where you take a step back and look at how different elements of Southern culture are marketed in the South. I mean, this idea and abroad. I mean, again, sort of, if we dovetail on the idea that the South is a place of wide open spaces, it's also a place where rebellion is closely associated. I mean, the Southern rebel becomes a kind of an icon for the bohemian lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the intriguing and complicated part of marketing this, is that, you know, in the case of the magazines that I wrote about in my chapter, you've got one that's a lifestyle magazine and in many ways carries on some Southern traditions in terms of dressing and other consumptive objects, but in other ways uses bohemia as a way to market something that's not as boring as bourgeoisie lifestyle. So there's a really interesting play and use of bohemia as a rebelliousness or as a way to sort of move away from something more, move towards something more authentic, that's maybe perhaps not as boring as the lifestyle of the reader's parents, for example.
But I suppose that might bring us to the much larger question, and I'm not sure it's addressed directly in these essays, which is whether anybody goes off the grid in modern capitalism. The fact is, there's no place to stand outside the system. It always gets commodified. Even dissent is, you know, you can buy your rebellious Che T-shirt and get the mug that goes with it.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing the people who wear those T-shirts wouldn't give up a single latte in the defense of actual democracy. So you've got that going for you, I suppose.
Yeah.
And what about that? But when you try to take on questions like this, whether or not there is even really a counterculture left, it seems to me, and Lindsay, I'll put this question to you, whether using the comparison of the South, what is bohemia in the South, is a better way to get at that bigger question of whether there's any counterculture left. Was that part of the thinking in putting together these essays?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, global capitalism is this huge monster, of course, that we know that gobbles up everything. But I think that there is a tension, right? There is always some kind of pushback, and then there is a commodification. So I think we're interested in these moments of pushback, and then to what extent they're successful or not. I mean, I would argue that there is still a counterculture, and it doesn't mean that it pops up and it lasts forever. But I think that there are these moments where the counterculture emerges and flourishes, and you know whether it can sustain itself or not is a question. But I mean, I think that the old time punks are they're pretty off the grid playing this music, and and riding the trains. And
yeah, the question is whether it can sustain itself as long as it stays off the grid and is no longer a threat. But to the extent that it becomes replicated and scales up, that's the point at which it gets commodified and digested rather than remains a growing movement that it could have any leverage against the current system. I mean, you talk about it. One of the examples you use, for instance, is the blues revival movements and how they kind of swim in and out of different cultures and different regions as the sort of bedrock elements that provide for the blues, that provide the nutrition for the blues, change from place to place. Maybe you can talk about the blues and how that plays a part in this.
Sure. Scott Beretta actually wrote a really great essay that's in our volume about this. And, you know, he looks at these moments of how, you know, the blues comes out of the South, comes out of the Delta, but then you have these amazing blues musicians in places like Chicago and Detroit and St. Louis, places like that. And what you find is that, you know, a lot of these blues men and women, you know, they had to move for economic reasons. So they head up north, they get factory jobs, and the blues disperses. You know, it's like this great system of culture and music. And then you have this moment where people want to get to the root of things. You know, they want to go back. And so you have these kind of revivals back in the South, back where the blues emerge in places like Mississippi and Memphis. But then it becomes commodified, of course, like as we talked about, and there's these blues trails, right? So you go to this particular bar, you go to this particular house, and you kind of consume this past. But you know what, I would argue, and I think we argue in the book, that even though these places and times are being co-opted, there's still a value in remembering this history.
Well, you also talk about the fact that your experience with the queer scene in Durham, and again, that might be another example of what you're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, these are moments where just a beautiful thing pops up in a place you never imagined. And you know, one of the things I definitely wanted to mention in the book is when Mr. Lady Records was located in Durham, started by the musician Kaya Wilson of a band, The Butchies, and Tammy Ray Carland, who was a photography professor at UNC. And for me, when that emerged, it was like such an exciting thing, because not only did you have these kind of, you know, queer punk records coming out of Durham, but they were, you know, they were challenging ideas about sexuality, about gender identity, and a whole scene was created, a community. And so we like to think about it as like the pink triangle inside the research triangle. And I think of just as a young queer person in the South, it was so important to me.
Well, raised in Tennessee, right? So that, I mean, it talks about going from one place in the South where you couldn't find this to another place in the South where there was the ecosystem then and now that allows this to survive.
That's where, let
That's
me,
right.
yeah, Sean?
Add quickly. I think one of the conclusions that we came to is that, and I think we say perhaps in the book, but I think I'm willing to say fully that in the work of Bohemia, I would argue, is more important in the South than other places like New York City and San Francisco. San Francisco, it's a lot easier to be part of the Bohemian culture in New York, whereas in the South, I think it's doing much more important and influential work in terms of the dominant culture.
Well, and influential in the sense that if it succeeds here against those odds, then what you learn and what you can take away from that could be useful down the line when, you know, a much more sturdy and resilient movement is required. Thank
it's
you.
Such a great concept for re-examining the South. I think Bohemia is a very useful lens to do that.
Sean Chandler Bingham and Lindsay Freeman are the co-editors and contributors to a new book called The Bohemian South, Creating Countercultures from Poe to Punk. Sean is an assistant dean of academic affairs at the Honors College and a professor of sociology at the University of Florida. Lindsay is a professor of sociology at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. Sean and Lindsay, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more about their work at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we'll talk about a new novel, A One Woman's Road to Country Music Stardom. Stay tuned.